Position number 22071, Rule 1.
This is John Collier, Reel 1. And if I could ask you first of all, John, you know, we are getting on to your experience with the Berlin airlift, but it would be interesting to know about your life sort of before the war and during the war.
Yeah.
Whereabouts were you sort of born and raised?
I've lived in Leicester all my life. I've just moved from one side of the city to the other. That's the furthest I've ever moved. My father... And his father before him were connected with the shoe industry in Leicester, and like many boys of those years, I followed on. I wasn't terribly happy at school. I couldn't wait to leave and start out in the world. My father was a shoe designer. I went and studied shoe manufacture at the factory where he was a director, and also at the local technical college, until I was called up for my national service. I had always been interested in aviation and always wanted to make a career in the Air Force, but unfortunately in the last few months of the war in Europe, my elder brother was killed in the Air Force, and the Air Force wasn't my mother and father's favourite unit, and so I decided I wouldn't make a career of it, but I would go in and just do my national service.
Before I ask you about that, what was your experience here? You know, what happened in Leicester during the war?
There was a lot of activity, obviously, in the Leicester area during the war. It wasn't very badly bombed. We did have some air raids, but not terribly bad ones compared with other cities. There was a lot of military activity around Leicester. In particular, just before D-Day, the American paratroops were all stationed in the area, and I well remember going up to the local airfield because we knew something special was on, not exactly what it was, and it turned out it was General Eisenhower had come to inspect the airborne troops prior to D-Day. We used to go up and watch the aircraft on this airfield. I then joined the Air Training Corps. Again, that was not very popular with my parents, but they realised I was very interested, and this resulted in me going into the Air Force to do my national service. We were sent to...
Do you have any particular memories of the war? You know, any events that, apart from the sort of Eisenhower visit, that... You know, was your life affected very much by it, would you say, as a schoolboy?
Yes, I think it was. Most schoolboys at the time were very interested in what was going on, any military activity. We all collected bullets and any war souvenirs that we could. Life rather revolved around the war, really. It was a very... start thing. When the American paratroops left, the camps that they were in around Leicester all turned into prisoner of war camps, and we began to get a lot of German prisoners coming into the area.
Did that have any effect, you know, on the sort of life of Leicester, do you think? Was there...
Not really. Originally, they were all kept very confined to the camps, but towards the end of the war... And in fact, after when the war had finished, they were allowed out of the camps, and then they came in contact more with the civilian people. It was very difficult because when you've been brought up most of your life to hate a nation, and that whatever we might think, that propaganda that we had during the war torture, that they were all bad, and this was one thing that probably the airlift taught us more than anything, that they were human people like us. There were good and bad amongst them.
having to do national service?
On the whole, I look forward to it. I was going amongst aircraft, something I enjoyed. I was going into a different world. This is another thing that it taught you. You met all sorts, from very refined lads to very, very rough lads, and you were all in the same boat and all together on this. I always remember one particular fella who had a most strange ethic to me. He would steal anything that wasn't screwed down, and if it was screwed down, he'd unscrew it. But I shared a room with him for some time, and I could leave money, anything about, and he wouldn't touch it because we shared a room. But if the lad in the next room left it, that was his. And this was the sort of thing that was very strange to my own upbringing.
So it was sort of broadening your outlook, was it?
Very much so. yes. It's,
how about your initial training? You know, having got into the RAF, was it easy enough, you know, to go into the RAF? Did you have this choice?
Yes, because I had served in the Air Training Corps before, and we did get a priority to go into the Air Force. The only problem I had with that was that the trades that were offered to national servicemen on the whole were very poor at the time that I went in. They were virtually all the jobs that the regulars didn't want to do. And there was nothing very much that interested me. And when we'd finished our initial training, we had an interview as to what we wanted to do, and I couldn't really find anything. And they said, well, what do you want to do? So I said, well, I'd like to be an aircraft recognition instructor. And they said, well, we don't have any aircraft recognition instructors in the Air Force, in spite of the fact we'd just been trained by two. The only aircraft recognition instructors are with the RAF regiment on anti-aircraft squadrons. And that was the reason I went into the RAF regiment. I said, well, OK, I'll go into the regiment and do it. But at that time, the regiment had three types of squadrons. They had rifle squadrons, which I spent most of my time on, armoured car squadrons and anti-aircraft squadrons. I should have gone to an anti-aircraft squadron. I never saw an anti-aircraft squadron all the while I was in the Air Force. So I didn't think I was going to get any chance of instructing on aircraft recognition. But we had soon after we got out to Germany, another flight came out, and part of their advanced training was aircraft recognition instruction. And we hadn't got an aircraft recognition instructor on the squadron. And somebody turned up my notes and found I was interested in this, and asked me if I could do it, which was very unusual for somebody with no rank to instruct. And I did this on the understanding that when I'd done it, I would be posted back to the UK to do an instructor's course. Again, this never happened because we were too busy on the airlift. So I did some instruction, but never became a fully qualified instructor. Most of my time in Germany was spent driving.
I'm going to ask you about that.
Yes.
But, you know, going back to the beginnings of the airlift and your involvement, were you conscripted there, or did you volunteer to go?
No, we were just posted automatically. When we'd finished a basic training, which is known as square bashing, we did trade training, and for that we were sent to Catterick. We did 8 weeks at Catterick. And from there, we had a mixture in the flight that we trained with. Some were national service, some were regulars. All the regulars were posted to the Middle and Far East, and the national servicemen to Germany. So it was an automatic posting, really.
Did you know much about what was going on at that time? You were saying, it was interesting earlier, your attitude towards the Germans.
Yeah.
You know, how in the war, the propaganda and that. Mm. Regarding Russia, of course, the propaganda, I believe, was very positive, was it not,
yes,
towards
yes,
Russia?
Yes, yes, it was very different. Basically, we were taught the Germans were our enemies, the Russians were our friends. When we got to Germany, we found that, in fact, we were beginning to fall out, the Western Allies were beginning to fall out with the Russians, and it was a strange situation altogether, because we had Berlin stranded 100 miles within the Russian zone. For some strange reason, it was agreed that the Western Allies would have access by road, rail, canal and air, but the only written agreement was for the air passages. There was no written agreement for the ground, and this helped the Russians to close down Berlin considerably.
What date did you arrive?
We were at home for Christmas 48, and we went out immediately after Christmas 48 to Germany. The airlift, of course, had started in the June, so it was already fairly well underway when we arrived there.
So how did you travel to Germany?
In a very rough means. We went over to from Harwich to the Hook of Holland on troop ships, and from there we went on a troop train from the Hook of Holland to Germany. The trains then were in quite a state, and all the seats were wooden, and it's quite a long journey, especially on a wooden seat. And it was quite a journey. But my first memory there was, we were taken off the train at a station called Bentheim, which I think is just inside Germany. It's close to the Dutch-German border. And we were given a meal. And the food we were given was cooked by Germans, and it was far better than anything we had ever been used to. And this transpired right throughout a time in Germany. We did have our own cooks, but we also had a lot of Germans, and the food out there was very much better than we'd been used to in the UK. The only place it was even better was when we were on American bases, and then it was luxurious.
So, having arrived in Germany, where were you based?
We spent the first night in a former SS barracks at Bunkeberg, and from there we were picked up by truck and taken to Wunstorf, which is close to Hanover and was the main British base for the Berlin airlift. When we got there, originally the Dakotas had been stationed there, but the Dakotas had then moved on, and the RAF Yorks were there, and some of the civilian aircraft that took part.
So quite a mixed lot of aircraft, was it?
Oh yeah, yes, yes. Mainly Yorks, but this was one of the big problems on the British side, that we were using a variety of aircraft, and that did give problems for the loading and that. But a lot of the liquid fuel for Berlin was flown out of Wunstorf, and amongst the people there was Air Vice Marshal Bennett, who was very famous. He led the Pathfinders, or formed and led the Pathfinders during the war. He had then taken up a post with British South American Airways, and they were equipped with a very new airliner, the Tudor. But unfortunately, these Tudors, which were going to be the flagships of the British civilian air fleet, two of them were lost over the Bermuda Triangle with all the passengers on board, and the civil aviation authorities removed their passenger licence. So Don Bennett still believed in these Tudors, and he bought two of them to start a freight company. And he was very fortunate because the airlift developed almost straight away and kept him very busy. And he came out and he was a larger than life character. He was during his RAF service, he'd been an air vice marshal, and he was considered very, very high. But you were just as likely to find him in overalls changing one of his aircraft engines as flying the aircraft. These Tudors, they took freight in initially, but then, a lot of the civilian aircraft, they weren't ideal for loading. They'd only got very small passenger doors, so they converted them as tankers, and they carried liquid fuel into Berlin. I remember Don Bennett and seeing him about at Von Stuff quite a bit. At that time, obviously, I never knew his wife, but his wife later, after he'd died, joined the Airlift Association, and we became quite good friends. And unfortunately, she died last Christmas, but she was a lovely lady. And it was a great pleasure to meet and talk with her.
Do you think you could describe Wunstorf, you know, the airfield for me?
Yes.
Because obviously things had moved on by the time you arrived. Was it quite well developed for the airlift by then?
Yes, it was. The big difference with the German airfields, the Germans during the war had used much lighter aircraft than our own, and therefore they didn't have a lot of concrete runways. Most of their airfields were all grass, and the billets and various buildings were all in pine woods, and it was very, very pleasant to live on a German airfield. But very quickly, the heavy traffic that we used turned the airfield into a quagmire, and that was one very great problem. There was when the airlift started, I believe just one runway at Wunstorf, one concrete runway, but it was hard standing for the aircraft that was the problem, and that was initially solved by using some material known as pierced tracking, which had been used for making temporary runways during the war, and then eventually concrete was laid and it became much better. But that was a great problem with all the airfields in Germany at the time, and the airlift in fact was only expected to last a few weeks, at the most a few months, and the actual blockade went on for 11 months, the airlift went on longer, and it really churned up these airfields, obviously, but it was solved in the end.
And what were the facilities, you know, apart from the runways and the aprons? Did you have good hangars, storage facilities?
The hangars, obviously, we didn't have anywhere near enough hangars, and we were, when we were supplying Berlin, to supply a city isn't just a question of supplying food. Everything that Berlin used, toothbrushes, toothpaste, everything had to be flown in, and therefore a lot of the hangars were used for storage of these goods. And this was one of our biggest problems, because there was an awful lot of looting went on. The Germans were very, very short at that time. And obviously, it was Aladdin's cave to them, and things went missing. And we spent a lot of our time trying to secure goods. The living conditions that we lived under were very good, really. This is one thing in retrospect that has surprised me. I mean, we were living 2-3 to a room. Whereas the air crew were living in attics and everywhere, and I'm surprised we weren't turned out. The only thing I remember we did lose, at that time the forces had just started using sheets, and we lost all the sheets. We just went back to blankets, but That only lasted a month or so, and then they eventually got enough sheets for everybody, and we went back to sheets again.
So your actual, the group you went with, how many of you would there have been in your particular unit?
There were, at the time we went out, there were about 25 to 30 of us.
All National Service?
Yes.
And what was your dedicated role, apart from the, you know, security?
It was mainly security. Even at that time, nobody was sure that the airlift was going to succeed, and therefore plans were laid to evacuate the whole of the British forces from Germany, and we didn't really suffer any problems. But had this have happened, then we would have suffered, because we would have been left behind to keep the airfields clear until all the aircraft had left, and then make our own way. And this was one thing we did learn about the Russians. There were an awful lot of them. Where we counted in hundreds, they counted in thousands. And I think we would have been rather quickly overrun by them. So that was the axe that always hung over our head. For instance, we were using quite a few German drivers at the time, and they realised if we had to evacuate, we couldn't take the German drivers with us. So an awful lot of extra drivers were trained out in Germany, so that we could bring any transport back, hopefully. But it was probably very few people realise it was very close to a war situation again.
Did you feel that all the time?
Yes. There was. It was probably not quite so obvious to us as it was to the people that were actually in Berlin all the while, because they were very surrounded, obviously, and they wouldn't have stood a chance of getting out. We might have done, but I rather doubt it.
That evacuation plan, which obviously you saw, John, you know, in your role as security, do you remember what the plan was? You are able to...
Well, it was mainly a question of laying out a defence for the airfield to hold the Russians away for as long as we could, to get the aircraft out, because that would be considered the prime thing. And though there were quite elaborate defence plans, I think it would have been a question of holding on as long as we could, and then every man for himself, I think, really. I think it would have been another Dunkirk. I think it could have been as serious as that.
So your work was really mainly looking after the stores, was it?
Yes.
To make sure they weren't pinched.
Yes.
How much stuff did go, and by, you know, were there devious means of getting this?
Well, there were a lot of German civilian lorries employed, and they used to go in and out the airfield. So it was very easy to put things in these lorries. And another of our jobs was to search these lorries as they went out. But no way could we search every lorry that went out. So it was just a question of picking on one or two. And I remember one particular incident where one of our fellows, checking a lorry, found a small amount of butter. It was only perhaps one block of butter, not a lot. And the German driver spoke no English, and we hadn't got anybody at the time on the gate that spoke German. So they put him in the cell in the guard room until they could get an interpreter. And when they came back, the German had hung himself from the cell bars. And this young lad that had stopped him was mortified by this, and he said, "It doesn't matter what I see in future, I don't see it." And, I remember that as a very stark thing. But that really didn't matter. No way could we stop odd amounts of butter. It was large amounts that mattered. I mean, we had a railway line coming into the airfield, and all the liquid fuel came in railway tankers, and we lost one of those full of fuel. And I can remember we were pulled up before the CO, and he said, "Even you fools can't lose one of those." He said, "We've got four railway lines coming into the airfield. It's on there somewhere, but we never found the truck, let alone the fuel. I mean, just too easy to hook it up onto the back of something and off it went." Well, that sort of level we had to take care of, but no way could we stop small amounts going out. And the initially all the loading of aircraft was done by the British military, particularly the army, and they obviously got absolutely worn out at this, and they recruited a lot of Germans to do this work. And I always remember the Germans used to get a big bowl of soup at midday, and that was one of their prime rewards for working on the airfield, because food was very difficult, and this soup was a godsend to them.
I suppose in those days you wouldn't have had things like security cameras, would you?
Oh no, there was nothing like that. It was the human eyeball cameras were the only ones we had. And an airfield is in those days, I mean, most of those that you see now have wire fences all the way around. They didn't have wire fences around in those days, so anybody could burst out in any part of the airfield and get away with things. It was impossible to stop pilferage, and there must have been an enormous amount. And food and cigarettes in particular at that time were very, very valuable currency.
It seems strange that there was no sort of barrier around the airfield.
Yes,
yes. Well, why was that? You know, given sort of wartime security and later.
Yeah, I suppose when you think of the amount of fencing that you need to go around an airfield, it's a vast amount. And in those days, there were far, far more airfields than there are now. I suppose it was literally impossible to fence them in. The other things that were used, the RAF police had dogs, obviously, and they were very valuable in that work.
Do you remember any particular incidents of people you caught, you know, or
No, not a lot, because I spent a lot of my time driving, and it was usually taking a flight out to an area to stop and search or something like that. I do remember one occasion when a truck burst out across the airfield, and we knew it was up to no good, and waved it down, but it didn't stop. And the officer that was with us did tell us to open fire on it, which we did. And he was most disgusted because we didn't manage to stop it. But at the time, we were only armed with Sten guns, and those against a lorry, they would just bounce off a lorry. And I remember he hadn't got any ammunition for his revolver, and he was waving this empty revolver around and saying, "I could have stopped them with this. You can't stop them with a Sten gun." But that was just an odd incident. But one thing that was very good, I was rather disappointed on the Airlift Association that I'd never met anybody that I knew. And a few weeks ago, a fax came through to me with a new member, and I thought, I recognise that name. And fortunately, there was a telephone number with it. And so I rang this person up and said, what squadron were you with? And he said, 56. I said, yes. I said, you were my flight commander. And it was a Flight Lieutenant Warren who had been my flight commander when we were in Germany. He now lives, he's 84. He lives at Bury St Edmunds, and I went down recently to see him. And I've still got a copy of a letter he wrote to my parents while we were in Wunstorf, and he was staggered and couldn't even remember writing these letters.